I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. My heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart.
And good morning. You are listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org, and we're at iTunes at College Radio. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and as always, Writers on Writing is dedicated to the art, craft, and business of books. Today is Wednesday, July 20th, 2011, and my guest is Glenn Retief. He's author of the memoir, The Jack Bank, a memoir of a South African childhood, published by St. Martin's Press. It was published in 2011, and Kirk has described it as a visceral and emotionally complex and impressive first book. His writing has appeared in numerous journals here and abroad, including Virginia Quarterly Review, the Massachusetts Review, and the flagship South African journal New Contrast. He teaches creative nonfiction at Susquehanna University in Pennsylvania. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, Barbara.
Oh, you're here.
I'm here.
And we have you for the entire hour, and I'm delighted to talk to you about your book. You know, I first heard of it from Melissa Bank. We were having coffee or lunch or something in Chelsea in New York in April, and we were talking about a memoir I was working on, and she said, "Oh, you really must read Glenn's book." And
well, I love just about everything that you mentioned in that sentence. I adore Melissa. I love Chelsea. I love April, and I like either coffee or lunch. So.
Well, let's start about the book. Talk about the genesis of the book, of the Jack Bank.
Well, the genesis lies in an experience that I had in whites-only government school in apartheid South Africa, 1985. That's where I grew up. And The Jacks are or were, I don't know how much the word is still used, actually, but when I was a kid, they were teenage slang for corporal punishment that was very widely used in South Africa at the time. I had a prefect in boarding school, and your listeners who are familiar with Harry Potter will know that a prefect is somebody who is in charge, an older boy or girl in boarding school who is responsible for maintaining order and discipline with the younger kids. And I had a prefect who got a little carried away with the discipline and the corporal punishment, and he invented a bank where we could deposit beatings for infractions ahead of time, and those beatings could earn interest. And the idea is that when we did something wrong, we could make withdrawals and come out ahead because of the interest that we'd earned. So that's the life experience that forms the foundation of my memoir. But the idea for the book came from a couple of things. First of all, when I immigrated to the States at the beginning of 1994, this was just one of the many things that jumped right out at me in my conversations with other people. I was living in a very international sort of artist commune at the time. One of my housemates was Swiss, another housemate was Jamaican. There were Brazilians hanging around and Venezuelans. And I would tell people about these kinds of experiences, all of the corporal punishment in boarding school, the hazing, the violence of my childhood, or the things that I remembered from childhood, things that I just took completely for granted. And I just thought of as normal and natural and what everybody went through in high school. And they all reacted with complete shock and said, "What? What happened? How could this be?" And that's when I first started to realize that there might be a story in this. And then Melissa Bank actually was my first writing teacher. She taught a fiction writing class at the nonprofit where I was working at the time, Housing Works. And Melissa just loved an early short story that I wrote called The Jack Bank. She encouraged me to carry on working on that. And then forgot about it for years. Then I wrote an essay called The Jack Bank that got published in Virginia Quarterly Review in 2008. And that's when agents started contacting me and saying, "Wow, we love the way that you wrote this. This is really what you say about South African culture and about human nature through this metaphor of the Jack Bank. We think that this can be the basis for a book." And that's where when I wrote a book proposal, and an agent ended up selling it, and then the book itself took about 2 years for me to write.
Wow, there was a lot in what you just said that I want to talk about, and I think the first is, I find it interesting that you were studying fiction, it began as fiction, and sort of found its way to nonfiction. Talk about that, because I think sometimes with new writers, or even maybe material that is somewhat edgy or risky, authors or would-be authors are a little nervous about writing it as fact because of what they might reveal about themselves or reveal about others. A lot of the time I think true stories are disguised as fiction, and yet you took your story and decided to go with nonfiction.
Well, I wish I could say that I'd thought very carefully about the pros and cons of writing it one way or another, but it was much more higgledy-piggledy than that. The class that I was in was my very first writing class. It had been a childhood dream of mine to be a writer. As a kid in school, creative nonfiction and memoir wasn't really on my radar screen, as is true for many people in this country too, for many of my students who come into the undergraduate program at Susquehanna University don't even know what creative nonfiction is and have only a very vague idea what memoirs are. So that's who I was when I was in Melissa Bank's class, is I just sort of wrote it as fiction because that was the topic of the class and because that's what I thought writing vividly or writing creatively meant. But it wasn't fiction. The short story was a sort of a passionate letter to this guy, my prefect from eighth grade, and it was a very lightly fictionalized, if at all. But what Melissa liked about it, and my classmates, was a strong voice and a very strong feeling, and that had a few near hits for publication, but it didn't get published. And then the next time I came at this was after having studied creative nonfiction at Florida State University in the PhD program in creative writing. And there's another whole story there. I went into that program writing fiction, and then I took a class in creative nonfiction only because a teacher that I really wanted to take, Bob Shakoches, refused to teach anything but creative nonfiction. And one of the things I noticed was that the other students in my MFA program responded in a different way to it when I called it creative nonfiction. And whether it was this story or many of the others in the book, the story of growing up in a game reserve in northeastern South Africa, brushes with wildlife, my college years of coming out of the closet and being involved in the anti-apartheid movement and protests against beach segregation, all of that stuff, if I wrote about it as myself, laying claim to it and standing behind it, people were engaged at just another whole level. And they took it more literally, as they should, and had all kinds of questions about it that were artistic questions, emotional questions, and political questions, factual questions. So I liked that. I liked being able to connect with readers at all of those different levels. And so that's when I started writing primarily memoir and personal essay. And so when I next returned to this material, The Jack Bank, it was logical for me to write it in that genre. I will say that, now with hindsight, there are obviously pros and cons. In my book, names and identifying details have been changed upon legal advice, and that's very important both pragmatically and emotionally for me, is to protect people's identities and to not invade their privacy. So that's one big issue. And another one is the way that people take memoir as opposed to fiction. One of the things that does irritate me a little bit is I think people overestimate the psychological work of writing memoir, and they underestimate the literary work. I think they take memoir very literally.
Mm-hmm. Keep going about that, because that's really interesting.
I think people read memoir that comes off as clear, that comes off as wise or insightful, and they imagine, here's somebody who's done a lot of therapy, or somebody who's had a lot of life experience, is very mature, maybe some wisdom has come to them as if by grace through life or spirituality or whatever, but that's what it takes to write memoir well. And I, of course, would agree with that. I think some of that is necessary to write good fiction too. But a lot of the wisdom of memoir comes from writing and rewriting, comes from just writing lots of drafts. And to me, achieving wisdom about my life experience as a memoirist is almost inseparable from discovering the emotional story, surrendering to the material, letting the story write itself. And by that, I don't mean that I'm doing what a fiction writer would do and just making up incidents. But there is a way in which I feel I have to let the material lead me, and I have to find out what the emotional story is in my memories. It's not the same as writing autobiography and trying to get down everything significant or everything relevant. It's much more literary than that. It's much more about being pulled under by a story or allowing oneself to be set fire by a story. And that's, that's literature there. That's something that I share in common with other creative writers. And much of what readers see as my wisdom about my life is really just my having done the work of a writer. and having found the story that's there in my unconscious.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and my guest this morning is Glenn Retief. His memoir is The Jack Bank, a memoir of a South African childhood, published by St. Martin's this past April. You know, what you just said, what I have found with beginning memoirists is that often the first drafts read as a series of impressionistic scenes, you know, like instead of taking us into the story. And that's a tricky one, because I think writers may feel that, well, this is sort of how I feel, this is how it is or was, as opposed to here's the dramatic story. You know, in that it is similar to the novel form, where you have to find the story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't. I think then it just reads as a factual or literal autobiography, and that only really works if you're Nelson Mandela or Bill Clinton or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason for anybody. Anybody in the world, really, except for maybe a small handful of people, to be that interested in the literal details of my life or even your life. You know, I think the reason people read memoir by ordinary people is to learn the important life lessons, or to connect at an emotional level with another human being, and they read it for that imaginative experience and that emotional experience. And if you can't find that in your material, Michael Steinberg, who edits the journal Fourth Genre, has an essay in his anthology about writing memoir and creative nonfiction. And he says that this is why he rejects about 97% of the manuscripts that arrive at Fourth Genre. It isn't because they aren't competently written, and it isn't because the subject matter itself isn't worthy of exploration. It's because it stays at that literal level that you were talking about. They're just incidents. They're just things that happened.
Mm-hmm.
Even vividly imagined scenes, but they don't reach that deeper level.
Yeah, I think we want story. We want story,
yeah.
Whether we're reading a novel, whether we're reading a memoir, and that's, you know, that's once a writer can get their head around that when they're working on a memoir, it starts making sense.
Yes, and the only difference is that there are limitations to how you can find that story when you're writing memoir. You can't use material that isn't there. You can't make it up out of whole cloth. You've got to find where is the drama in my memories, as opposed to let me invent the drama.
Yes. Well, this would be a perfect time to hear a little bit of your book. Would you read to us?
I'd love to. And I'm going to be reading from a chapter called The Castle. It's about two-thirds of the way through the book. And I've arrived at university. I'm in my first year in college and living in this very castle-like university residence, which will be familiar to many students or former students in the U.S., in the University of Cape Town. And I've sort of drifted off a little, having arrived at college. I've been very isolated, been feeling very, very alienated, and then something happens that you're about to hear about.
Okay.
I don't really think of my outside window, the one facing the grass in the street, as being the sentry box in the curtain wall of the castle, the logical spot for the world to reach back in and demand my participation in it. So on the day there's a knock on it, a loud, insistent rat-a-tat on the glass pane, and I see the tall, dark-skinned, slender boy in the fitted jeans, bright white sweatshirt, and clean Nike sneakers standing outside. Out of politeness, I open up. Yes? I'm my mother, ready to send off a Jehovah's Witness. But this guy isn't intimidated by my brusqueness. Hey, man, he says. We're neighbors. I live there. He points to the window to his right. I hear you through the wall sometimes, moving around. But no one ever sees you, man. You're like a ghost. These last words, which could so easily be reproachful, are delivered with crinkling eyes, as if he's on the verge of breaking into laughter. I could get angry and defensive, but the truth is he seems the soul of good nature at this moment. He is all friendly curiosity, written onto his raised eyebrows, his wide dark eyes, his oblong head, unashamedly tilting to get a better view of my room. "Well," I say, "I'm here." I invite him in. It seems to be the polite thing to do, as well as what he's waiting for. So he walks around the building to come in the front. In my room, holding a mug of tea, Aubrey, for that's how he introduces himself, strides around chameleon-like, his neck leaning first one way and then the other. He is as tall and skinny as I am. Probably side by side, the two of us look like stick insects, one of us burnt umber, the other pale ginger and freckled. His frizzy hair is neatly trimmed barber-style, as is his moustache and goatee. By contrast, my shaggy brown locks curl out in all directions like Diego Maradona's. In my plain black boxer shorts and my holy white T-shirt, I feel as dowdy next to him as I do next to the golf-playing crowd. But as he looks around my room, his face shows no disapproval, just fascination and intrigue, then puzzlement, then mild amusement. "Poetry," he explodes when he sees the T.S. Eliot collections. "I don't read that crap, man. I like novels with action. Forget long descriptions. Do you know James Hadley Chase?" "I do not. It sounds a bit like an upmarket automobile." "Brilliant, man. You can't put his books down. Where I come from, he's the main man." He pauses at my French impressionist posters. "I see you artsy." "Yeah, man, I'm seeing you're one of the fartsy ones." "Me, I'm a commerce student, man. I like business." I nod to say to him, "Yes, you're different from me." Still, I'm enjoying this Sherlock Holmes performance of his. Now he's bending over the rubbish bin and examining the tuna cans and noodle tubs and saying something about how I obviously don't like cafeteria food. Certainly there's no one who has taken anything like this kind of interest in me since I moved here. There's something refreshing in his frankness. He says, but doesn't finish his thought. Then his eyes narrow, making him suddenly streetwise. "You moved down here to be with black guys. Why, man? What's up with you?" What there is comes out all in a jumble. The meeting at the beginning of the year, where we voted not to reopen discussion on the door policy. Bill and his desire for an atom bomb in Soweto. Losing my religion. The drunken night when Bill punched a guy. The way I tell the story, it is just because Bill enjoys fighting. Some instinct tells me not to bring the word homosexual into Aubrey's immediate line of vision. I mention the people in the dining hall with their tennis tees and their holiday houses. At the end, I say, "Probably I just don't like people very much. I learned a new word the other day. Have you heard of misanthrope? It means a loner." Aubrey looks at me long and hard. Then he leans his head forward. "Interesting, man. Interesting. You really don't understand yourself, do you?" He pauses, waiting for my reaction, but I don't give him one. "You don't know who you are." He stops again, scratches his goatee. I shrug, what's this guy talking about? But then he continues. "You sound exactly like a black guy, man. The way you talk, your worldview, you're exactly like us. You're not a misanthrope. Crazy. It's just that you see things as we blacks do."
Thank you so much. That was Glenn Retief reading from The Jack Bank, a memoir of a South African childhood. That is such an interesting scene because of what it what changes in you, the narrator, as he says that and after he says that.
Yes, the chapter is really about this friendship that develops with Aubrey. A very, very important friendship when I look back. And really what I'm trying to get at, I think, in the chapter is how fused for me race and sexuality were growing up as a white gay South African. The two went together right from the beginning. In some of the earliest chapters in the book, I talk about the tension between English and Afrikaans. And as a very young boy, I also felt an outsider. And I didn't like the, I didn't really like sports. But because we were just two English families in a predominantly Afrikaans-speaking village, I just thought that not liking sports and not being interested in the sort of games that young girls and boys played with each other, the sort of the beginning of early sexuality, you know, I thought that my difference with all of that, which in hindsight has to do with has a lot to do with being gay, I thought that was just because I was English and the other kids were Afrikaans. So right there, you know, I sort of didn't have a concept of sexual difference, or I just sort of fused it in my mind with cultural difference. And then when you know, when I was in boarding school at age 12 in eighth grade, when I was having that experience that I talked about, the Jack Bank, the sort of hazing and what we call skiving initiation in boarding school, I was kind of picked on more than most of the other boys. And clearly, with hindsight, I was sort of pegged as a gay boy and therefore needed toughening up more than the others and all of that. But at the time, what my prefect said to me, and this is a statement that Americans often find very shocking, but it's pretty common when I was growing up. He used to say, you know, the reason I'm picking on you so much is that you're a waste of white skin, and you know, I want you to act like a white boy. So you know, so then that idea got into my mind, and I knew that there was something different about me, and that I didn't quite fit in, but I thought it had to do with race. And so in my friendship with Aubrey, what he was really doing was affirming the sense of difference and not belonging in my own culture. And for a while I thought, well, you know, this is my community. This is where I belong, is the Black South African community. And, you know, I think politically that did make sense at a certain level, that white gay South Africans were very persecuted by the apartheid government, and so were Black South Africans. So there was a kind of a link between different minorities. But much of the book's journey, among many of the topics that it tackles, is figuring out that in my case, what I needed to deal with was sexuality, not so much race.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I'm so glad we have you for an hour. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we have so much more to talk about. So all of you out there, stay with us. We'll be right back with Glenn Retief and the Jack Bank.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Listen to Writers on Writing every Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Pacific Time on 88.9 FM, KUCI, in Irvine.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org and at iTunes at College Radio. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we continue to have Glenn Retief with us. He wrote The Jack Bank, a memoir of a South African childhood, published by St. Martin's. Before we go on, Glenn, tell us your website so people can find you.
I'm at www.glennretief.com. I should probably spell that.
Yes.
Since that's not going to be on everybody's fingertips. That is G-L-E-N, that's the easy part, and then R-E-T-I-E-F.com. And one easy way of remembering my surname is to think that it is just like relief, but with a T in the middle instead of an L.
Right. That's a good one.
I have to get, as you can imagine, you know, dealing with customer service and so on, I have to find quick ways to.
Well, anyway, so much more to talk about. You know, what you just read, maybe if we could talk a little bit just about the sort of the craft of writing memoir, and your dialogue works so well throughout the book. How do you recreate dialogue when you're writing a memoir? And you obviously, well, I'm assuming you didn't keep a journal throughout your entire life.
No.
And, you know, how do you recreate it and have it work?
Well, that's a great question and a very important one for me. I really need people to understand what I've done here, which is why I have an author's note at the end explaining my artistic methodology. People often ask me, you know, are you a walking video camera? You just remember everything so precisely, moment by moment. Well, I don't. Lucy Greeley got asked, you know, after a reading of Autobiography of a Face, how did you remember all of that? And she said, no, I didn't remember it. I wrote it. And people were very shocked, and I think people maybe misunderstood that a little bit. Mm-hmm. and thought that she just dreamed up the whole thing. But really what I did is I gave myself permission to reimagine my memories moment by moment. So I had the general gist of all the things that I describe in the book. You know, they're all there as memories, but they were fragmentary memories. And so, for example, in that scene that I read, I so clearly remember this, you know, this meeting with Aubrey. I remember the knock on the window. I remember what the window looked like, the little garden outside. And so I remember the general, you know, generally what happened. But I allowed myself to reimagine what that would have been like moment by moment. It's written in the present tense. The present tense is also a signal from me to my readers to say, you know, that's what I'm doing because this happened 20-something years ago. If you write about something that far in the past, in the present tense, clearly that's an artificial artistic construction because 20 years ago is in the past. It's not in the present. So, you know, so I'm reimagining moment by moment. I'm trying to remember what my room looked like. I'm trying to remember what he was wearing. Many of the details are best guesses. So, for example, that white sweatshirt that I remember so clearly, was he actually wearing it that day? I have no idea. I mean, my memory isn't that good. But probably he was, because he often wore it. And so it was natural for me, as I reimagined the scene, it was natural for me to put that on him, because that's what I most often remember him wearing. So that feels fair to me, but it is a sort of a reminder that memoir is art, not fact, and that it isn't academic biography, and it's not journalism. It's somebody reimagining the past, and without that ingredient of imagination, I don't think the book would be much fun to read. So that's how dialogue works for me too, is I remember what his voice sounded like, and I remember what he said. The texture, the syntax of what he said, the all of those mans, you know, that's him. That's how I remember him talking. And the content, the specific things that he said, like, you know, that that I saw the world as a black man, I didn't see the world as a white man. Those are things that I remember him saying. But line by line, what I'm doing is I'm being a writer and I'm creating dialogue. And this is my best guess at what he said or what he might have said. But it's a sort of a mixture of memory and imagination.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's what someone would have worn, what someone would have said. And
yes.
As long as you can be true to that, then it's okay.
It's good faith.
I
say to people that this is the whole book is a good faith guess. I'm doing my best to be accurate, but I am using my imagination to. But paradoxically, you know, there's something about using imagination like that makes it somehow more accurate. You know, if you're not too literal about it, literally it makes it less accurate than, you know, me factually reporting my memory and saying, you know, this is what I remember and this is what likely happened. So literally I'm taking a liberty, but in doing so, I'm allowing the reader to share in the texture of my memory.
Mm-hmm.
There's a greater intimacy in that. And I think, so I think in that sense, it's more accurate because the reader's getting more of a visceral sense of what I remember.
Mm-hmm. What about embellishing or creating composite characters, or say you had three visits by Aubrey at your dorm room and you combine them into one. Is that appropriate?
I think that's okay as long as it doesn't change the essential story.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you one example of where I did do that, and I do talk about this in the author's note as well. But I have another chapter called Best Friends, and in it I took two conversations that happened on different days, and I make it one conversation, and it's the final conversation that I have with my best friend from boarding school, where we talk about the fact that we're not attracted to each other, and we're only going to be friends, even though there's this incredibly deep love between the two of us. And there I felt that it was just purely logistical and didn't have an emotional meaning. That those two conversations happened at different moments. And it just felt true to me to have it be one conversation. It felt completely unnecessary and distracting to explain the logistics of why they happened actually in two pieces rather than one. And I thought it achieved nothing in terms of honesty with the readers. And explaining all of that, all it did is just took away from how effective that was dramatically. So there I did it. I feel a little bit differently about composite characters, because that has real-world implications for people. So if I'm putting words in the mouth of somebody who didn't
mm-hmm.
say them,
mm-hmm.
then that's different. But my friend James doesn't care at all about my having made that conversation a composite conversation. Nobody cares.
Yeah.
So that works.
Hmm. Early on, there's a scene that you wrote so wonderfully about when you were a kid and with your brother and sister, and you're alone in a tent with your parents down the way a bit in a trailer. Your dad, I believe, is doing research, and there's a lion. Lion, I believe, nearby.
A couple of them.
It was such a suspenseful scene because, you know, obviously you survived because you wrote the book. But, you know, what happened?
Oh, you've just, what a plot spoiler for all of your listeners.
But, you know, you don't know what else happens, right? So talk about that. Talk about recreating a scene of suspense and talk about that scene in particular because, it came at such a perfect place and you really just played out the scene just perfectly. Lots of dialogue. It went on the right amount. Talk about that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. A very clear memory, obviously. This one we've talked about in my family for years and years. And what happens is that the three of us, my brother, sister, and I, are sleeping in a tent. And it's right next to, or just a little bit away from, the trailer where my parents are sleeping. Interestingly enough, in writing the scene, I have one regret, which is that so many readers have contacted me and asked me, why were you sleeping in the tent? Why weren't your parents in the tent and you in the trailer? And really what it is, it's just a very small point, but it's almost unthinkable, the statistical chances of, lions killing right next to the tent like that. So minuscule that it wasn't reasonable for my parents to have anticipated that as a danger. And, we, of course, like kids anywhere, we wanted to sleep in the kids, and we wanted to sleep in the tent, and my parents saw no reason why not. So we were in the tent, and I remember waking up when the guy rope got kicked loose, and then I remember the sound of what I learned later was a kudu antelope being killed. And lions kill antelope by tearing out their throats, so there were a lot of sounds that went along with that, and it was very, very scary. And what's important in that scene too, and I'm so happy that you liked it so much, but you know how we were talking earlier about the emotional story?
Mm-hmm.
This is a very good example of that, and when I read the scene to audiences, I often get asked about it, but people say, oh my God, I'd love to write a memoir, but I never had lions kill outside a tent. And to me, the scene only works because of what has gone before it and because of the deeper themes that it engages with. Because I've talked about how, as a kid, I'm living in this game park where my dad works, and it's an unfenced village, so there are all these rules to keep us safe. But as a kid, I just can't really get my head around the concept of mortality. And I'm dying all the time to provoke danger, just to see what will happen. And then the tension in the chapter increases, and there are some near brushes. Lions on the basket courts one morning when I go to school, and then this is sort of the climactic scene. And what it is that I suddenly realize that all my fantasies about being protected by angels and being protected by God, that it isn't enough, at least not in this moment. I really do feel extremely vulnerable. And I try, with a sort of a child's magical thinking, to imagine, okay, if I, my dad calls at me from the trailer and says, just stand still, just stay still, don't make any noises, don't move around, it's night, these lions are hungry, if I try to chase them off or do anything now, it's likely to cause more trouble, they're likely to become aggressive, and that's not a good thing. So what needs to happen is you just need to stay very, very still, and eventually the lions will be full, and then we'll be able to chase them off, or they'll move off by themselves. And so that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying not to breathe too loudly, not to talk. And then I'm imagining, well, if I put, if the lions can't recognize a tent, because that's what my dad said to me, if the lions can't recognize a tent, well, then maybe they won't recognize a sleeping bag either. So if I pull the sleeping bag over my head, I'll just be a pod, and they won't know what to do with it. But none of it works. It's still very scary. And at one point, fall asleep and wake up again, and I can see the lion's shadow. And that's another very clear memory, the moonlight lighting up the tent and then the shadow of the lion. The penny drops that night, at least as I reimagine or remember the story. That's kind of the first real memory I have of feeling mortal, of feeling very physically vulnerable. And that, to me, is what allows that scene to be so suspenseful and to work. If it was just a literal scene, if it was just a kid in a tent, mm-hmm. with lions outside, it would still be scary, but not that scary.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah, that's a great point. You've mentioned theme, and I'm always interested in theme and how. Or when it needs to come in a memoir. I mean, even a novel, but we're talking about memoir. And is it something that is not the writer's problem, not the writer's place to imagine theme as they're writing, or does it come after you have a draft and you ask yourself, well, what's the theme? And now it's time for a rewrite and I need to rewrite according to theme. Or is it something that that a reader should tell you, oh, your book is about whatever, whatever it is. You know, at what point does theme come and is it important?
Well, I'd love to hear your experiences, too, as a memoirist. I think there's a little bit of a difference in fiction in that with memoir, there's more of a tradition in it, and it seems less intrusive to the reader when you consciously reflect on the meaning of experiences. So you have this double voice, the voice that's in the moment, and then the voice that looks back to try to make sense of it. So I think there's a little bit less show, don't tell in nonfiction than what there is in fiction. But I think, particularly for the kind of memoir that I've written that reads a lot like a novel, there's also a lot of similarities. For me, as a writer, I never think consciously about theme. That would be a trap, I feel, if I was... I mean, I have now, you know, in hindsight, partly because interviewers ask a lot about theme and audiences ask about the ideas in the book. But while I was writing it, I wasn't trying to write a book that dealt with mortality. That's something that that has come to me afterwards when people have asked me about it. But when I was writing it, I was just trying to think, what is the emotional story here? It was more intuitive than logical. And it didn't come after just one draft. I didn't write one draft and then ask, what is this about? I wrote chapter by chapter, and I typically wrote two or three drafts. One exception was the chapter that I wrote about my grandfather abusing my sister. That one just came out just about as it is in the book, first time round. But for every other chapter in the book, I wrote it probably two or three times, completely throwing away early drafts, before I got to a draft that felt to me like it was saying something important. And I use the word felt. It's not that I figured it out or that I would have been able to exactly articulate it, but by instinct it felt to me like there was an energy in the work, there was a voice in the language, there was an intensity in the story. And with hindsight, it seems to me that's when I discovered theme, but that's not the way I thought about it as I was writing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. I mean, it does seem at some point you do have to think about it, but I agree. You know, if you're writing it according to theme, then I would think that a memoir would come out sounding moralistic or sounding, okay, here's what I'm trying to tell you, and
yes.
Here it is.
It would seem like a self-help memoir or a politically didactic memoir.
Mm-hmm.
You can overcome alcoholism if you just do X, Y, Z. I think that's a whole different genre, really. And literary memoir tries to be more subtle.
Did you have to do any research for your book? Or was it all kind of your experience?
A little bit of research. I was sort of worried. An example of this is in my second chapter, where I'm talking about wanting to be an Afrikaner and then at one point wanting to join an Afrikaner nationalist youth organization. So I often had to dig for help in remembering the precise lyrics of songs that I recalled, what the Voortrekker youth group uniforms actually looked like. So I did a lot of Googling and a lot of putting out queries on Facebook and to my friends and so on to try to find those kinds of details and get them right. This is a little, funny little story, but there's one song that I quote, and I remembered some of the lyrics, but not all of the lyrics. The only place I could find the lyrics was on a white supremacist website called Storm Riders, and I clearly remember going to that site at work at Susquehanna University and thinking, oh goodness, what is IT going to think if they see this on my weblog?
Yeah,
and then fact-checking later on, calling people and just saying, what do you remember? And some parts of the book are much better fact-checked than others because of who I'm in touch with or who is willing to talk to me.
Yeah, and what do you think would have happened if there were people that maybe you wanted to fact-check with were impossible to reach or were no longer living or, whatever. I mean, any reason that you couldn't reach them. What would a memoirist do at that point?
You've got to go with your best guess.
Yeah,
you've got to go with
sure.
what you remember. And there's guesswork anyway in turning fragments of memory into a story. So you're guessing at sequence, and you know, you remember something happened and it was sometime between, you know, 1992 and 1993. So, you know, so you make a guess and you know, you do the best that you can. Some of the later chapters in the book are actually the least fact-checked, because the boyfriend at the time that I'm writing about didn't respond to my emails or phone calls.
Mm-hmm.
So I really wish I could have fact-checked that. I'd feel much better about the factual accuracy of all of that if I had another brain remembering back and saying, yes, that happened and that didn't happen. You know, some of the memories that I have in the book, I was stunned by how accurately I seem to have remembered them. And then there were some other just freaky mistakes and false memories where I couldn't believe that I got that wrong. I misremembered who my best friend took to the matric farewell, which is the equivalent of the senior prom, and that just stunned me. But that's testimony again to the plasticity of memory and how our recollection of the past becomes a story in itself.
Mm-hmm. We have just a couple of minutes left, and I wonder if along the way in writing The Jack Bank, you ever reached a point or points where you either felt blocked or you just didn't know where to go next, you didn't know where the story should go. Did you, and if so, how did you write yourself out of those places?
It was wonderful having a year and 3 month deadline as a result of the book contract from St. Martin's. So I couldn't yield very much to writer's block. The flip side of that is that I wrote the whole book in sheer terror at what would happen if it didn't all hang together. I had nightmares about it being, 9 or 10 chapters in search of an overarching narrative at the end. So I kept going. I don't remember being stuck, but I remember lots of moments of great fear, even in a particular chapter where I'd written a draft or two or three, and I just couldn't figure out what this chapter was supposed to be about. It just seemed so rambling to me, so much what you were talking about earlier with just a bunch of memories, just a bunch of scenes, and I just couldn't see what it was supposed to be saying. And so that caused a lot of anxiety. But because of that deadline, I just pushed through it and couldn't really afford to take a break even and worry about it. And then the moment of exquisite relief was reaching the end and saying, okay, this is a story. The book as a whole is a journey, and it's an emotional journey.
Mm. Well, you've just done a gorgeous job, and all of the wonderful reviews prove that point, that this is a memoir that is that has legs, and everyone should read this. I so appreciate your time. I wonder if you just have any quick last words for perhaps the writers struggling through a memoir or hoping to write a memoir. You are listening.
I think one thing is that when you get to the end, it's going to seem easier than how it looms ahead of you. When I got to the final point, I thought, gosh, I should never have been so scared. I should have just trusted my unconscious that there, you know, because sitting down every day and writing a book, or sitting down regularly and writing a book, you know, in some part of you that this is a story that needs to be told. That's what gets you there. And if you didn't have that intuition, you wouldn't be able to work on this, and you wouldn't have the strong desire to work on this. So trust that instinct. Trust that the book is there, the story is there, and let it find itself, because it will.
Mm, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been wonderful.
You're welcome. That was Glenn Retief. His book is The Jack Bank, a memoir of a South African childhood, published by St. Martin's Press. And his website is glenretief.com, glenretief.com. And thank all of you for being here with me. I made some notes as we were talking, and one of the things I wrote down is what he said is people read memoir to learn important life lessons and connect with another human being. If you're writing a memoir, that's an important tidbit to keep in mind, to learn the life lessons and connect. That's why we read stories, huh? To connect with another's experience. So you have been listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. Stay tuned. We have music coming up. We have reggae coming up. And I'll see you here next week with Robert Olin Butler and Anita Shreve. Talk to you soon.